Chester, I'm going to take you all the way back to 1973, your book, The World of the Urban Working Class.
Uh-huh.
It sounds like that's a very ephemeral demographic. Is it so, or do they pretty much stay roughly the same population?
Well, that was a very interesting project. That was sort of, it's a study on the West End of Boston, a neighborhood largely Italian-American neighborhood, very tight neighborhood. There's a sociologist named Herbert Gans who was part of that project and wrote a book called The Urban Villagers, because it was like an urban village, even though it was right downtown, literally about a half a mile, quarter of a mile from City Hall. When people left the West End, they would say, I'm going to Boston, even though this was an intrinsic part of Boston. That area was completely demolished in the late 50s and early 60s under the bulldozer approach of urban renewal. And what happened was, very interestingly, the head of Massachusetts General Hospital was right in the neighborhood, and the head of the psychiatry department, Eric Lindemann, had done some classic studies of the Coconut Grove fire back in the early 40s, of a nightclub fire that killed close to 500 people, about the grieving mechanism, in other words, how people adapt to loss of a loved one. And his perception was that the people's kind of attraction to that neighborhood, their connection to that neighborhood, was similar to their connection to a loved one. And the loss of that neighborhood would be equivalent to the loss of a loved one. So he got funding from the National Institute of Mental Health to do some very elaborate interview studies, which I was part of, to talk to people in the West End before and after they left that area. And that was a largely white, almost exclusively white working class population. That's why the book is called The World of the Urban Working Class. And these people, in fact, yes, they have kind of left the city. They were forced out, and they lost a great deal of the meaning in their lives. And this has unfortunately been the characteristic of urban renewal. I mean, it's been largely a program that's disproportionately displaced blacks. As a matter of fact, it had the sort of negative name Negro removal rather than urban renewal, but an awful lot of whites were also displaced by it. And those kinds of neighborhoods really are almost a thing of the past, sadly, because of rather insensitive urban renewal. And not only just insensitive to what those issues were, but it was clearly class conscious. This was in this particular case, as in true of so many urban renewal projects, this was an instance of upper income housing. A major politically connected developer wanting to build new housing on this 48-acre site, and now you have these sort of fancy apartments there. And in the case of San Francisco, it was a convention center, an office building. So it's really displacing one group in the society for the benefit of another group in society, and always in a kind of a rather non-progressive direction, a non-fair direction.
I want to get into the Poverty and Race Research Action Council in a little bit, but I'm very interested in the Chair of Planners Network that you founded. What was that all about?
Well, I'm an urban planner by trade. I have a degree, both a doctorate in city and regional planning, and I've very much been sort of what you might call an advocate planner rather than a traditional planner. I mean, the work I did in planning when I was in the Boston area largely was around working with community groups pretty much to oppose what official planning agencies were doing in the way of highway projects or urban renewal projects that were damaging to the neighborhood. So we had when I was in the Boston area, we had a group called Urban Planning Aid, which was a group of advocate planners who offered their services without charge to community groups, and sort of they became our clients. And then when I was teaching at the Harvard Graduate School of Design in the City Planning Department, a student version of that called the Urban Field Service, where students in teams worked for community groups. So the kind of planning I did was very much different from traditional sort of physical planning, sort of public interest planning. It sort of recognized that there were certain interests that planners were serving, and we were mainly interested in serving the interests of low-income minority communities. When I moved to San Francisco in the early 70s, I began something called Planners Network, which is a successor to a 1960s group called Planners for Equal Opportunity, a group of planners who were mainly assisting the civil rights movement. And Planners Network is kind of a loose association of about 1,000 urban planners, community organizers all around the country, to create a sense of community. There's a bi-monthly newsletter. There are events that happen in localities. I started it in 1975, ran it until about 3-4 years ago when the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn took it over. Partially, I was a little bit kind of tired of it, and also they had an institutional base for it, which I didn't have. That's basically what it is. It holds annual conferences and really tries to develop a perspective on urban planning that is kind of equity-oriented, that meets the needs of the most needy in the society.
Now, you brought up San Francisco. Tell me a little bit about the transformation of San Francisco.
Well, I lived in San Francisco from 1970 to 1980, and I moved out there originally when I left Harvard and the teaching world to join something called the National Housing Law Project, which was located at the University of California, Berkeley, the law school. And we were very involved. It was mainly lawyers, and one of the main projects they were involved in at the time was the so-called Yerba Buena Project, which was a large-scale urban renewal project displacing around 3,000 mainly low-income elderly single persons in order to expand the city's financial district across Market Street, which has always been sort of this big divide in San Francisco. Everything sort of wealthy was north of Market Street, everything south of Market was kind of low-income. So this urban renewal project was designed and was effectively did this, built a new convention center, the Moscone Convention Center, hotels, office buildings, etc. The problem was that at the time they were displacing these elderly single men without any adequate relocation plan. And fortunately, there were some very good legal service lawyers at the time, both at our project and in San Francisco. A lot of these elderly people who are old union organizers, retired, living in sort of single-room occupancy hotels, and they challenged effectively the relocation plan and got a very sympathetic federal judge, Stanley Weigel, to stop the urban renewal project completely until the redevelopment agency came up with an adequate rehousing plan, which is a wonderful plan, actually. They've actually built a tenant development corporation, built some wonderful low-income housing, just beautifully designed, right around the convention center, which is very rare. And what I did originally was develop a book with some other people around that urban renewal project, just sort of explaining the politics and economics of it and the opposition to it. I then expanded that to a larger treatment called The Transformation of San Francisco, which is about how the city has been transformed in the last few decades into a largely sort of upper-income enclave for both economic activity and housing and neighborhoods. That's a book that I've just updated, and the University of California Press will be coming out with it in the spring. The new version is called City for Sale, The Transformation of San Francisco. And it's all about development politics and how the city has really been transformed into something that doesn't have the diversity, the cultural or political diversity that it had at the time I was living there, largely as a result of market forces, because it's such an attractive place to live. And more recently, the whole dot-com phenomenon, the development of the dot-com industries down in the peninsula. You've had an enormous number of people with great wealth who don't have any housing there and don't want to live down there. They're young, and they want to live in San Francisco. So they've been buying up houses at astronomical rates. When we lived there, we bought a house in 1972 for $33,000. We still own the house. We kept it because we might want to go back. I'm told that house is now worth close to $1 million. I mean, it's just unbelievable what people are paying for housing because they want to live in the city and there's a very limited housing supply.
Now, this all brings to mind sort of a media buzzword we've been hearing for the last year and a half, urban sprawl, I guess media buzzwords, two of them. How would a progressive urban planner such as yourself view sprawl, and how is that similar and different from the mainstream urban planning industry's view of sprawl?
Well, it's interesting. The main concerns about sprawl have been coming from environmentalists, primarily, who are concerned about the loss of farmland, the loss of biological diversity. My main concern, the concern of my organization, is largely with racial and class issues having to do with sprawl. That sprawl has been very much an issue in the past of white flight out of the central city. Using urban renewal, using highway programs, using FHA mortgage insurance as a way of moving out of the city and creating this sort of bifurcated metropolitan area where you have, until recently, largely low-income minorities living in the central city and middle-income and upper-income whites in the suburbs. And as the inner suburbs become more and more diverse racially and economically, people, the whites who want to flee this, move further and further out into the exurbs, and which causes, you know, tremendous problems of transportation, of infrastructure, commuting, et cetera, environmental issues largely. We're concerned primarily in doing something about metropolitan disparities, not only the racial patterns in metropolitan areas, but the enormous wealth and income gaps between whites and blacks. And that's very much reflected on sprawl issues, because the inner city housing generally has much lower value, which means schools don't get as much financing. But now you're having a return to the city of people who want to gentrify, who want to come back to the city. Partially, they like the diversity, or they like the intensity of that life. The housing style is better. They want to avoid commuting. But at the same time, then they're pushing the existing residents out into the inner fringes of the suburbs and creating similar kind of racial gaps and racial patterns. So that would be our main interest in the sprawl issue.
Now, as executive director of the Poverty and Race Research Action Council, you're located in Washington. Do you do most of your work out there, or do you get to?
We're a national organization, and we have two primary functions. One is a networking function to bring the organizations and activists who work on civil rights and on anti-poverty, economic injustice issues more in touch with one another. Traditionally, the civil rights groups have not paid too much attention to economic injustice issues, and the anti-poverty groups have not paid too much attention to race. So we do a lot of networking through local meetings, through newsletters, through publications. The other thing we do is, that's the research and activism connection. We really see the value of targeted social science research as a tool in helping advocates, whether they're working on legislation or litigation or community organizing or just educating the public. And so we give out small research grants for social science research on the intersection of race and poverty, so long as it directly is designed right from the outset to support some kind of advocacy work. We've given out about 100 of these grants so far, and we found it very effective. They're relatively small grants, maximum $10,000, but relatively small amounts of money can produce very good work when it's done by committed people. And the other thing is that even though these are not disinterested parties, the people who want the research to come out a certain way because they've observed something and they want to document it, even though it's coming from, say, it's not the traditional disinterested researcher, the quality of the research is so good, and that's part of our job, is to make sure that it's good, that a judge or a legislator or a newspaper editor really has to take it seriously. So we found that to be a very effective program.
You've got an article called A Case for the Right to Housing. Just briefly, what is the case you make?
Well, it's a funny, it's actually quite recent article. The Congress in 1949 and the major post-war Housing Act, which established urban renewal and created sort of an additional public housing program, Congress set forward the national housing goal, not a right, of a decent home and suitable living environment for every American family. That's verbatim, which also implies that it has to be affordable, otherwise there's no meaning to that. Well, and back in the mid-30s, President Roosevelt, in his second inaugural address, has this famous, you know, lament about one-third of the nation ill-housed, ill-clothed, ill-fed, et cetera. Well, it happens to be that we are moving farther away from that national housing goal since 1949, and there's probably still one-third of the nation ill-housed if, by that definition, we not only include slums and overcrowding, but non-affordability, people who simply cannot afford to pay for existing housing without taking away from other necessities of life. Contrary to that fact is that there ought to be a right to housing. And what I do in that article is cite all kinds of religious statements by Catholics, by bishops, by Jewish organizations, international UN treaties, UN resolutions, that all talk about that there should be a right to housing. And what I'm putting forward is sort of a moral political argument in that article, that there should be a right. Housing is so basic to everyone's life, about their social life, their economic opportunities, their schooling, that there really must be a right to decent, affordable housing, an enforceable right. And it's expensive to do. We're going to have to deal with racial issues. But until we deal with that, I think the society is in real trouble and failing people miserably.
Now, a lot of the I'd say all of the issues we've discussed of, as far as urban renewal and urban planning seem to revolve a lot around race and socioeconomic issues. My question to you, and it's going to be one of the last ones I ask you, is how do we fight this?
Well, part of it is simply more awareness. I'm afraid Americans tend to be blinded in a lot of areas. I mean, for example, there's this whole notion around now that somehow because of the civil rights movement, because of affirmative action, we don't have to worry about race anymore. If we just ignore the colorblindness approach, if somehow we're paying too much attention to race, somehow if we just ignore race, it'll go away. And we really have to look more realistically about what the existing patterns are in schools and housing and employment and the criminal justice system, the health system. People have to be much more aware of this. That's the first step. The second thing is I think we have to develop some realistic programs to deal with those injustices and understand that they are costly. To have decent schools in the central cities, to have decent housing, to have job opportunities, to have a health right for everyone. And there are 42 million Americans who do not have health insurance. All of this is going to cost money, and I think we have to be prepared to spend the money and not look for kind of regressive tax cuts, and not look for spending so much money on a defense establishment that is no longer needed, and really put the money where it ought to be in a democracy in terms of creating fairness for everyone. So those are the two things I would say are most important.
All right. Where can listeners go to find more information on the poverty and race research?
Well, we have a website, www.prac.org. Our address is 3000 Connecticut Avenue Northwest, room 200. Washington, D.C. 20008, and they can email us at info@prac.org, and we'd love to hear from some of your listeners.